So there'll be some challenges, but I've got to say it's been this wonderful opportunity to be part of this incredible history with a great, you know, product, in our case, the National Arts Club. And we have a chance to update it. We have a chance to make it relevant to the conversation around culture today, which is really what I saw as my goal. For many, many years I worked in the arts, no one would ever say, I'm going to an event at the National Arts Club tonight, or a journalist would come back and say, hey, I covered something last night at the National Arts Club. It just wasn't important to the conversation of culture any longer. We don't have to be the producers of it, but I want to be part of the conversations. In a country that has no Minister of Culture, there is a need for someone to bring people together. And I believe the National Arts Club can play some of that role.
This week's guest is Sydney-born, New York-based Ben Hartley, Executive Director of the National Arts Club, what he describes as a 122-year-old startup. Ben recently invited us to his spectacular Gramercy Square location to record this fascinating interview. Ben recounts his early years and the positive influence of his parents, his adventurous and analytical father, and his strong, emotionally engaged mother. Ben describes how his worldview was expanded and his curiosity sparked as a result of being taken on a grand European canal boating tour when age 7. Ben describes his embrace of discomfort as a means of pushing one's capabilities and his approach to seeking out serendipity. At 23 minutes in, we discuss the common threads running through the career path he has taken. We discuss his journey to the National Arts Club and his broad experience in arts management, including the international rollout of the Guggenheim to Bilbao and beyond. At 29 minutes in, Ben explains the mission and structure of the National Arts Club. He provides a succinct overview of the history of the club, being the first club to welcome women as members, and some of the events from its colourful history, to the characters that defined the unique institution and the recipients of its renowned Medal of Honour. Ben also describes how COVID has enabled him to apply his creativity to innovate and pivot the service of the club, develop a vibrant digital programme and build community and connectivity across the city and state. He goes on to describe the recent exhibitions curated in partnership with the new art collectives that have emerged in New York during the Black Lives Matter protests. For anyone that's struggling to reimagine or reinvent their business or brand, or deal with personal challenges, I think Ben's refreshing perspectives will surely provide inspiration and provoke new ideas. Ben, welcome to the Impossible Network podcast.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
It's wonderful that you've welcomed us into this wonderful establishment, which is called the National Arts Club.
The National Arts Club here on Gramercy Park in southern Manhattan. Yeah.
And we're going to come on and talk a bit about that and its history and what you're doing with it now and going forward in the future. But we always start with our guests' life and before what they're doing in their professional life, in your case, the arts. So I'd really like to understand a bit more about your childhood, where you grew up. Now, I think anyone listening to this will maybe get a sense that you're definitely not American and you're Australian. And I believe you were born and grew up around Sydney in Australia. So intrigued if you could maybe elaborate a bit on that upbringing and the impact that your parents had on your journey and your worldview.
I heard some comedian answer that, I was born at an early age, but yeah, that was me. So I was born at an early age in Sydney, Australia. My parents, typical Australian immigrants. My mother was born in Australia, but of Greek parents, came from a small island called Kythera. And my father, born in the southern part of New Zealand, and then moved to Australia when he was 20. I grew up in a middle class. In fact, in Australia, we all think we're middle class. No one's upper class, lower class. We all think we're middle class. So I grew up in a middle class family. Older sister, younger brother. Well balanced, nothing remarkably traumatic. I grew up, obviously, with a life of no particular hardships. I grew up in the public school system in Sydney and was influenced by my parents' sense of adventure, my parents' sense of risk-taking. And
do you think that goes with the territory? I mean, and the sort of the Antipodean sort of spirit of the New Zealanders. Every New Zealander I've ever met has always had been quite an adventurous character, and the Australians as well.
Yeah, my father was, by training, he was a mathematician and scientist, but by passion, he was an opera singer and croquet player. And so he's sort of left brain, right brain, a bit of everything. And he's also a bit of a dreamer. And so one of my early memories, my father used to help with a community neighborhood center setting up a marketplace, and he'd go around setting up the stalls, and that was part of his community service. But he also started buying these books by a gentleman called Roger Pilkington. Roger Pilkington wrote a series of books called Small Boat Through France, Small Boat Through Germany, Small Boat Through Holland, about his adventures on a barge through the canals of Europe. My father, who can barely swim, grew up in the southern part of New Zealand, very cold New Zealand, you don't swim a lot there, could do 25 yards backstroke, I think was his claim to fame, that was it. But he decided that he wanted to take his young family of three children and my mother to England, and then he bought a barge, an old boat,
wow.
And traveled along the canals of Europe for 9 months. So that's...
At what age?
I was 7, my sister 9, my younger brother 4. So
what
I think
an extraordinary education
risk
in the real
education.
World.
Yeah, I was doing BBC lessons at 11 a.m. and my mother was teaching us about the history of Germany if we were in Germany, or France if we were
heading
in
up the Rhine.
Yes, heading up the Rhine and, you know, collecting, soaking off wine labels off bottles. It was wonderful, yeah.
Oh, that's extraordinary. I mean, did your mother went along with this? Because a lot of parents would be like, no, we cannot disrupt the religion.
She's a very strong woman, my mother, but she also embraces my father's whimsy and his adventurous spirit. He's a very Anglo-reserved person, but my mother understands his quiet passion and is able to embrace that. And they've been married for a long time and mostly seem happy. So that's good.
Where do you sit on the spectrum of their characteristics?
I think more on my mother's side. My mother's very emotionally engaged with people, very touchy-feely. My father, though, is very analytical, so I've got some of that. I wish I had more of his mathematical genius, but I have enough of it to get by. So. Mm-hmm.
It must have been a bit lively during the Australia-New Zealand rugby games.
Well, yeah, my father, who has lived in Australia since he was 20, is annoyingly an All Blacks New Zealand fan to his dying day. And he has no greater joy than New Zealand beating Australia in anything.
Brace of Wallabies.
Yes, exactly. Which they do with incredible regularity, annoying regularity. So, yeah.
Okay. So that, do you think that journey through Europe really did set you on a path to having a life outside Australia? Because one of my questions was, you know, what led you to sort of leave Australia? So many Australians obviously travel the world when they finish university, but you know, your life has been defined by what you've done outside of Australia. Do you think it was conditioned and impacted by those early journeys that your parents took you on?
Yeah, I think so. I love travel. I'll be now more outside Australia than I've been in it, and I think that early introduction to different ways of life, different ways of living, different traditions, I think was, you know, incredibly informative and influential. Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
Mm. And presumably, I mean, the career you've had in art and PR and marketing, curiosity is obviously a core part of your character. And that journey must have also sort of cultivated an interest in things beyond just the parochial nature of where most people grow up and are conditioned to think that the world is centered around their, whether it be their city or their small town. So that must have given you a broader worldview.
Yeah, I was very aware early on that Australia was just a small part of a very big world. At the end of our evening news, it would always cover what the US currency was, what the pound was against the Australian dollar, and immediately I had a sense that we were just a small part of a bigger world, and we were actually, you know, a less significant part of a bigger world.
Yeah.
And that gave me a natural curiosity to find out what was going on elsewhere in the world. What else were people thinking? I love Australia and I love the lifestyle. I just always look in my life, I've always looked to feel slightly uncomfortable. That's what I've always embraced, a lack of comfort, a lack of feeling settled. And that's always pushed me into achieving or doing or experiencing more.
So you think you cultivate that?
I do. I do. I remember I did some theatre classes. I was a terrible actor, but I remember being told by a drama teacher that if you're feeling uncomfortable, that's good. You should embrace that. That means you're stretching. That means you're pushing beyond where you're comfortable. And so I take that sometimes when I'm in work situations or travel. I embrace this with my children as well. If I'm feeling uncomfortable, that's okay. It's okay to be uncomfortable because that means you're pushing perhaps beyond the known boundaries, and you're pushing to areas that are interesting or perhaps challenging or perhaps new and perhaps hopefully good.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I was reading the article about the coaching of an Olympic athlete by another Olympian and talking about having to live in that point between feeling comfort and discomfort and dissatisfied and feeling like you're failing, because if you've ever felt comfortable and you were satisfied, you know you're not working hard enough.
Right. Absolutely.
So there is something in that.
Yeah, that's a perfect place, right? To be satisfied, to feel good about where you've come from and what's going on, but then never quite to be fully satisfied and that it's you've solved it all. Mm.
How do you cultivate that? I mean, you're here now, you've got your own family. How do you cultivate that in your children?
In my children, you know, in everyday situations I've got now, teenage children, 19 and 16, yeah, I just remember we were traveling through Europe and we were lost somewhere, driving through some back town, back alley in somewhere in Italy. And I just, something, I don't know, I said to my children, you know, have you ever been down this street before? They said, no. I said, well, this is the first time we're doing it. And that's part of being lost. And that's the great serendipity. In fact, that's really, for me in life, serendipity is key. That's why I still read print. As opposed, I read digital as well, obviously, but everything I read is, I like it in print. I'll give you an example. This, I'm not a science person by nature, but I get the New York Times science section every Tuesday, I guess it is, and there's always something interesting in there. And yet, if I went to the newyorktimes.com and looked at it, and would I search for this drop down that is science, then would I find an article of interest? Probably not. So the serendipity of paper, that physical experience of going through the four sections of the Times and the Economist and other publications to allow you to be open to that and learning something new, I think that's a great, you know, way.
Yeah, I totally agree. I wrote a piece for the Huffington Post a few years back called The Future of Getting Lost. And it was really based on, this was around 2013-14, when I could see that social media was taking us down these very sort of closed into our little filter bubbles, just reinforcing what we believe, and really made the argument that we need to actively get lost if we're actually going to have a future where we are more expansive in the way that we think and that we understand and are prepared to reevaluate the way we think and what we know.
Yeah.
And how we act.
Absolutely. I mean, so I don't know if you saw The Social Dilemma recently, the documentary. Fascinating that if I can Google climate change in New York, I get one set of answers. And yet if I Google climate change in Arizona, I get a different set of answers. That's remarkable to me. And yet we live in a world where if you imagine the physical library that we all used to go to, we're largely restricting ourselves to one or two aisles by self-selection. We're going down those aisles. We're not wandering into other sections anymore. And in my life, I try and wander into other sections as much as possible.
Yeah, I've been reading that Apple are planning to launch a search engine and walk away from Google's reliance on Google. And I think the best thing that could happen is if they do that, or if they buy DuckDuckGo, so we don't get served up these answers, regardless of where we are.
Bing tried that, didn't do so well, but anyway.
Anyway, so just finally on your upbringing, is there any defining moment in your upbringing, your childhood, or any memory that has relates to where you are today?
Memories, really, the strong ones I have, a very warm Australian upbringing. It seemed constantly summer there. Obviously, it wasn't. But it seemed that in my voice coming.
Hang on a second. Winter there is summer in Scotland.
I know, exactly. Yeah. With my rose-colored glass. Probably some of the strongest memories I have were on that boat as we traveled through the canals of Europe. I had France, Germany, Holland, Luxembourg, 9 months on this boat.
Wow.
It was not comfortable by any means. It was a 34-foot Halvorsen. My father rented out the home that he'd just bought in Australia to some opera singers from the Sydney Opera Company. He got a job transfer to London. He took us young kids to two different schools in England. And he'd never driven a boat before. And so, you know, this was an adventure he wanted us to go on. I question how many people would do that now. Yeah. Certainly I wouldn't, you know. And so I give him a lot of credit for that. And those were incredibly strong memories. I had a bike. We'd moor in a town. The great thing about a boat, the good and the bad thing, is you're moving slowly. You can see life. You can hear life. You can smell it. So we'd moor in a little town, and then I'd get on my bike that had hard rubber wheels, not even inflated wheels. And the cobblestones of Europe, that's bloody hard work. And so we'd drive right off to the local town, and we'd learn a little Dutch if we were Flemish or French or German. My parents would give us a little bit of wine. It was a great and very formative memories for me, very strong. Unfortunately for my younger brother, he was too young to remember much. He is about it secondhand.
Okay, so what was school like for the young Ben?
So I went to Neutral Bay Public School. It was a good local public school, and I was extremely happy there. It was a school that was, so it was Australia in the 70s, racially mixed as far as Australia went at the time. Australia's now obviously become a very multicultural environment. But it was, you know, it was, I'd take the ferry to school and then a bus. Mm-hmm. It was kind of lovely to be on Sydney Harbour. I've always loved Sydney Harbour. And so there, I was very happy in up until around 11. And then in Australia, you go to high school at 12. And then I went to a boys' school, Sydney Grammar, a very traditional. There were 185 boys from primarily two feeder schools, and I was one of the about 15 or 20 kids who had not come from those schools. Very privileged kids. Sydney's political leaders' sons went there, business leaders' sons went there, and I felt completely at sea. I didn't know who these people were. I didn't know that environment. And for me, being at Sydney Grammar, I went in, I remember still the first day, and I'd always been a top student at Neutral Bay Public School. This was going, the school, Sydney Grammar, had the creme de la creme, the top, top students. And I remember going in, they were announcing A, B, C, D, E, F in the classes. And, you know, A being the smartest, F being the idiots, right? And they announced B, C, and kids gradually filed out to their B class, the C class, the D class. And I thought, either I'm a genius, I'm in the A class, because A and F were left, mm-hmm. or I'm a bloody idiot. Well, it turns out I was a bloody idiot. So I thought, what? I'd never experienced that in my life. The next year I got to the C class, so I was okay. But it was one of those sort of moments where I realized I was completely outside my norm and the environment I grew up with, deeply unsettling. It was a good experience. Sydney Grammar is, you know, a very high-pressure academic environment. I don't have any great love. The two things, I some good friends from there. I got to play cricket on a grass pitch. That was nice, because if I'd gone to the public school, it would have been a concrete pitch. And I got to learn the double bass, which was great. So I played in a jazz band and the orchestra, so that was enjoyable. You know, my parents, I got into that school and it was hard to get in, so they would thought they were doing the right thing. I probably would have been as happy at the local public high school.
Did that sudden realization that you weren't in that A group or B group, did it dent your confidence in yourself?
Absolutely. Yeah.
How did you overcome that?
Well, first of all, I wasn't the academic star that I thought I was. I was a top performer in my local public school, and I didn't know anyone in the whole school. I didn't know a single soul. And so I had two elements that were making it unsettling for a 12-year-old. And so I don't know, it dented my confidence for the first year, and then I gradually built friends, got friends, and, you know, cricket was my great passion, and that, you know, as a young boy, that's what I wanted to be. I wanted to be a cricket player, and my heroes were cricketers, you know. I didn't know what was out there otherwise, but that was my limited worldview.
Well, it didn't stop you going to university, so no. what led you away from cricket into a...
Well, there was obviously no career there for me. Wasn't good enough. But, you know, university, again, I just remember coming back from university and just telling my parents I was living at home. There wasn't a strong tradition of living on campus in Australia at the time. You lived at home, usually. I remember coming back and just telling my mom, I cannot believe all these great subjects I'm studying. I didn't know these things existed, sociology, psychology, theater, you know, marketing, all these things, philosophy that I had no exposure to and didn't even know existed. So I loved university, absolutely loved it. And it just gave me a window into a different world.
So what did you think your life was going to be focused on at that point, where you were just soaking up all these different subjects?
You know, I loved theater. I realized I wasn't good enough to be on the stage, act.
Cricket, cross-check,
yeah.
Theatre.
International cricketing star.
Right, what next?
Yeah, exactly. At 13 years of age, I think that was taken off the list. I didn't know. I barely knew what my parents did for careers. You know, my mother worked with disadvantaged children, youth and community services, working with disadvantaged children. My father was mathematician, scientist by training, but really ended up as an actuary and then ended up in financial planning. And so I had a vague idea what that was. I didn't know. I just knew what I liked, which I liked theater. I used to go to a local theater company. I liked sociology. I liked people. You know, and that's what I liked. So that sort of was my true north at that point.
Uh-huh. So you traveled while you were at university to the US,
yeah,
and found yourself for a semester here and doing a road trip across the US. What impact did that have? I believe you went to a place called Trenton,
yes,
New Jersey.
Trenton, not the end of the world, but you can see it from there.
Wouldn't have been my top pick, but there you go.
You know, I chose it as a completely naive 18, 19-year-old Australian.
Pinning the map.
Yeah, absolutely. I went to the foreign student office at the university I was going to. I said, I just want to get out of this country. I just want to try somewhere else for a while. I'll go on a scholarship. Have you got any scholarships to go anywhere? And I didn't know. They said, yeah, we've got one in New Jersey. I was like, where's that? And they said, that's the East Coast of America. Okay, sounds fine. And they said, if you get accepted, you get to choose to go to any one of the state schools in New Jersey. And so I got accepted. And I looked at a map in true Australian way. I used geography. In America, it's very much about which school did you go to, how good it is, how bad is it. Clueless. I was completely naive. I looked at a map of America. I saw that Trenton was near Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, and New York. And I thought, that's smack in the middle. I'll go there. Trenton, it turns out, is one of those cities that had experienced white flight in the 60s and 70s, had a very busy and successful industrial history. White flight, 50s, 60s, 70s, the downtown became largely decimated and emptied out. Trenton State College, which is called something else now, I can't remember what it's called. You know, good state college, nothing brilliant. But for me, it was, again, the most wonderful experiences to go there. Ended up buying a $200 car with a few friends and just drove across America and we'd do these magical trips where we picked up a friend's car in Portland, Oregon, and drove it back via New Orleans up to New York in about 12 days, which is, you know, 4,000 miles or something. It's a long way.
65 miles an hour.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, it was great. I loved it. And it was, for me, it was also an important time for me as an individual. I came over here. Americans didn't know about Australians. Still don't really, but the movie Crocodile Dundee had just come out. Yeah. So that was their formative educational process about what Australians were like. I grew up in the city. I was not a country kid.
People come over to going, that's not a knife.
Exactly. You hear a lot of that. But, you know, the fact that I spoke English with a different accent was enough to give me a free pass and for people to be interested and wanting to engage. So it was a great experience. I loved it.
So you came back to do a master's in fine arts and admin here in the US. So you'd all that you were on, you were set in a direction of arts at that point.
Why
back to the US to do that?
I came back because over my time in Trenton, I'd come up to New York for overnight trips and just go out all night here. And I loved New York. There was something magical about it, something
in the 80s.
So this was 86 I came to Trenton, 86, so it would have been 86, I'm sorry. So 86, New York was not in great shape, but it was a fascinating place. There was a lot going on in the East Village. There was a lot going on in the art world here. It scared me, you know.
This is before Giuliani cleaned it up.
Yeah, exactly. And so it was a scary place, or at least I perceived it as a scary place. But there was something about it that was so tantalizing and wonderful and exciting that I wanted to be part of it. So when I got back to Australia, finished my undergraduate, then I started looking at what classes and courses and master's programs can you do in America, in particular in the arts. And so my degree is sort of an MBA type degree focused on arts management. And that's where I ended up.
Yeah. Mm. And that must have been, I mean, that's a few years after the film, what was it, Fame, at the School of Performing Arts.
Which is where my son ended up going. It's LaGuardia High School here. So my 19-year-old ended up going there. Yeah.
Amazing. So obviously that was the allure of the US, stop you from heading where a lot of Australians head, which is the UK or staying home. Were there any key mentors or influencers that impacted that decision? Or guided you on your journey to the path that you've followed in the arts?
I remember as a naive 18-year-old, 17-year-old, reading an article about a man called James Wolfensohn. James Wolfensohn, so I was in Australia, I was reading this article. James Wolfensohn had been a very successful banker. He'd fenced for Australia in the Olympics. He'd learnt cello from Jacqueline Dupre, and then he became the chairman of Carnegie Hall when they were about to go under. So it's like, that guy has got it all figured out. You know, I really think he's a Renaissance man. Yeah, so I sent him a letter completely, again, naive, but what the hell. I sent him a letter as a 17-year-old. James Wolfensohn, Carnegie Hall, New York, United States. It actually got to him.
Wow.
And his office responded, saying, if you ever come to New York, let me know. P.S., 20 years later, 15 years later, I met him, and I met him through chance, and told him about this. He was very polite, of course. So I thought there was something that he'd combined business and the arts and sports. Those were all things I loved. He'd done it with great success and made a difference. So, and then he ended up becoming the head of the World Bank. So obviously public
services. Oh, that's fine. When you mentioned his name, I thought, wait a minute, I know that name. We interviewed him.
Oh, you did?
Back in 2001, 2002, I was working in San Francisco with an agency, Gray, and we proposed, before things were called branded content, to do a documentary series about agents of change for Oracle.
Right.
And they gave us the money, and we did a 13-part documentary series that aired on CNBC, funded by Oracle, and James Wolfenson of World Bank was one of our first interviews.
He wrote a book called The World's Banker about his experiences at the World Bank, which was a great book, I got to say, a fascinating book. So he was someone I identified in my teen years as someone who was doing interesting things. Was he a mentor? Not necessarily, but he was someone I took the effort to write.
As a role model, anyway.
Yes, so. Exactly.
So you've had an interesting career. If you look at your LinkedIn, progressing through arts, marketing, publishing, PR, worked in the Royal Court in London, Brooklyn's Academy of Music, the Guggenheim, which must have been amazing, the Museum of Art and Design up at Columbus Circle, and even a startup experience, a German startup, I believe, called Auctionata, that, like many startups, started and failed. And now you are executive director of the National Arts Club. What an incredible institution. So, I mean, that's a really interesting sort of path. What, looking back on it, are there any choices or any decisions you made that you would change looking back at the journey you've taken?
You know, I think about that occasionally, where we end up today and how we got here. And I can actually, and I on occasion will do this when I have a spare moment, usually on an aeroplane flight when we used to take flights, or sitting in the summer nights in my backyard. I think, how did I end up where I am right now? What are the decisions that made me end up right here, right now? And you can track it back. I mean, through the years, how I ended up. The National Arts Club, my career has always been about, I love ideas. I love taking a chance. I love trying new things. I love being uncomfortable. And I love the arts. And I love culture. Those have been the common threads throughout my career. Looking back, there is nothing I would change. I've had some horrific experience, professionally difficult experiences. I did lead a media company, and it's very lonely leading organizations. It's an organization with global offices, over 300 staff, and I work with a particularly mercurial owner, a wealthy woman. And there are probably some things that I would not have done again, would not do again, including working for this particular person. But it was an amazing experience, but the way that she conducted business didn't, I wasn't in agreement with it for the most part. So it was a challenging work.
But that must have had an impact on your style of leadership, of witnessing firsthand.
Yeah, absolutely. Because hopefully left me with a greater understanding of how people work differently in different parts of the world, how to motivate people, how to treat people in a workplace. Seeing what should not be done is as much a valuable lesson as what should be done. So in this instance, I was seeing quite often from this particular person, you know, ways of doing business that I didn't agree with.
Before we talk about the National Arts Club, working in an organization like the Guggenheim must have been quite an experience. At a time, it was, I believe, probably going through quite a big transformation.
Huge change at that time. So I was there. I worked as a marketing PR consultant in an outside company for 5 years prior to my time at the Guggenheim. Then the Guggenheim approached me about coming on board and managing what we ultimately called global sponsors. These are multi-year, multi-million dollar partners. Usually sponsorship and support of the arts is predicated on a one time, you have an exhibition, we support that exhibition, then we go away and we never hear from you again. The global partners were the idea that a corporation would support the Guggenheim, not only in Guggenheim in New York, but also in Venice. Also, we would then build Bilbao and Berlin also. And so I joined the Guggenheim when the director at the time, Tom Krenz, who was a polarizing figure in the museum world, was reinventing the way museums thought about themselves. The Guggenheim, like most museums, has a challenge. The challenge is, and an opportunity, the challenge being that 99% of their collection is in storage. The other 1% they get to show. So that's
incredible.
Yeah. So yeah, really in terms of an asset, you know, you've got this asset sitting in storage, which is costing you a lot of money, by the way. And so Tom's idea was take this Guggenheim brand, this internationally known brand with this iconic building on Fifth Avenue, utilize that collection with willing partners in a way that treats the art well. And the Guggenheim Museum Bilbao was the end result of that, which was the idea, you know, the idea of a, it required at least three different partners. It required Tom Krenz, the director, who was open enough to that idea of utilizing a collection. Frank Guerra, the architect who dreamed up this amazing building.
And then the Bilbao
Museum. And then the Basque government, who had the aspiration that they wanted to seed from Spain, basically, and they wanted to be this important cultural capital and financial capital, and a museum was sort of the jewel and the crown that they were establishing with metros, stations, port development, and other activities there. So Bilbao is an amazing outcome of three different forces. And it was at a time where museums had sort of reached the end of their structural destiny. And museum essentially is an 18th century idea. You put everything A to Z in a 19th century box. Usually they're palaces or some old building. And then at the end of the 20th century, we were faced with works that were digital works of art. There were large-scale works of Richard Serra, huge rolled steel. So museums had sort of reached the end of their structural destiny at the end of the 20th century. And so there had to be something next. And so the Guggenheim was right at that nexus right then. And also the way the Guggenheim thought about itself is very much influenced by how I think about the National Arts Club. One thinks about great institutions, and this is seen as sacrilege, but it happens to be true, as it's like being in a theme park, right? You have great rides. And a great museum, if you think about your great cultural experiences, you've maybe seen one or two exhibitions, had an educational opportunity, you've had a food opportunity, and maybe you have a retail opportunity. That's like Disneyland, right? That's like a theme park. When all those rides are working, you have a great experience as a human being and you interact with it. You talk to a museum person about that and that's seen as largely sacrilegious. But that's what the Guggenheim was trying to put forth. And that's certainly what I'm trying to do here at the National Arts Club. You know, everyone now talks, Richard Florida and others talk about the experience economy. This is it. The National Arts Club is the original experience economy.
Let's talk about that. You, as executive director, when we spoke before this interview, you described it as a 122-year-old startup. Can you explain what you mean by that and what attracted you to coming here?
You
mentioned a jewel. And on Fifth Avenue, this is like the jewel of Gramercy Park.
It really is. It's a lovely old building. So, 122-year-old startup, certainly, because there are many clubs around the world and many clubs in New York City. We're unique in that we're a 501c3. That's a non-profit institution. We're a private club, but we have a public mission, which means we basically have two universes, the private member experience, so you can come to our dining rooms and parlors and enjoy that. But then we have the very public program, where we do 150 programs a year. All of them are free. We have 15 arts committees.
That's a lot of programs.
It's a lot of programs. Yeah. And it was a great experience because my professional career had always been, you usually had a couple of gatekeepers, the curators, the artistic directors. They were the ones that decided what would be on your stage, what would be on your gallery walls. Here at the National Arts Club, we have 15 arts committees. Now, I must say, when I first got here, I thought that was going to be a nightmare dealing with, you know, largely amateurs volunteering their time. It turns out it's a really fascinating distributed model of developing content in its roughest form, most callous form. And it turns out that the perfect time for that model is now, during a pandemic, which means that a year ago, we had zero programs online. We had no YouTube presence. Over the last 11 months, 12 months, we've had 120 programs online, all because of our great fifth. We've distributed the model of content curation, which is our committees, bringing all these programs to the fore. So now we're doing 2, 3, 4, 5 programs a week.
That's incredible. It must lead to more of an eclectic sort of mix of programs as
which
well,
really goes
given the
back,
model you're describing.
Yeah, which really goes back to Charles Decay, the founder of the National Arts Club. So founded in 1898 by Charles Decay. Charles Decay was a literary critic and a poet for the New York Times. More importantly, he was the cultural attaché in Berlin. He comes back from Berlin in the late 1890s, and he says, why don't Americans support the arts in particular American art forms, like Europeans. He founds a club, and there were many clubs in New York at that stage, but he founds a club importantly focusing on multiple forms of the arts. He loved art and design. He loved literature. There were 8 initial committees. Many clubs existed here, so we've got next door to us the Players Club, which focuses on theatrical world. You've got the Salamagundi Club, which focuses on the visual arts world. The National Arts Club was all about this interweaving of different art forms. So he founds a club up on 34th Street. He does it with Lewis Comfort Tiffany, amongst others, as his founding members, with the idea of mixing of all the art forms together. And we have that to this day. He does something also that's interesting that was sort of before its time. He decides that women should be full and equal members. That was seen as a radical departure from the
norm. Before women had votes.
Well, before women had votes. And in fact, most clubs in New York City only allowed women as full and equal members from 1987 onwards because it was federally mandated.
Wow.
So, yeah, so there's Charles Decay and his founders saying, listen, we want women as full and equal members. To be fair, the reason that it has been recorded that he wanted women was, yes, he felt it was the right thing to do, even though there were reports of women not being in the club life. But he also was a realist. He realized there are a lot of competing clubs out there. I need to make sure I get as many members as possible. And if women are going to pay full price, all the better. So he was a pragmatist with a dream.
As a club, your members are artists. So when he opened the club to both male and female members, was it still restricted to artists only?
No, it was always a club about those who supported and loved the arts.
Yeah.
You didn't have to be an artist, but it was those who thoroughly embraced and supported the artistic lifestyles and artists in our community. So most of our biggest benefactor early on was Spencer Trask. He was a financier. He was not an artist. He, in fact, bought the building we're in. So in 1898, they use a building on 34th Street. 1906, they buy the building we are in, and it was Spencer Trask who actually provided, it was actually his widow. Spencer Trask died in a train accident. He'd given a large loan to the club to buy this building. He dies in the train accident, and his widow forgives the loan.
Wow.
And the club is able to buy this building and build a 14-story building behind us that has 27 apartments in it to this day.
Wow. Well, we'll put some of the images on the site where the show will reside outside of the podcast players that people can have a look at. Obviously, with the great history behind the club of things that have happened here. The mission, I believe, has remained the same. I'm just going to quote. It's to stimulate, foster and promote public interest in arts and to educate the American people in fine arts. So you mentioned it's a private members club and you've a 501c3. This clearly does give you that sort of broader remit than other clubs. How does that mission, although its description's the same, contextually in today's world, you must have your own set of challenges to bring that to life in today's digitally connected world?
Yeah, I mean, this club was founded about 20, 30 years after the Metropolitan Museum, well before MoMA. Contextually, you know, New York City Opera hadn't come into existence then, the Met had. And so it was providing something that the American people did not have at that point. The American visual art world had very much looked to Europe to lead, and it was only really 30, 40 years later that American art started coming into its own, internationally at least. And so the club was very much about promoting, in a very somewhat insular perhaps way, of promoting American art. Very much the way the Whitney Museum to this day still has that mission. We've expanded beyond that now. We're not beholden to focusing on American art. We have focus on international art. We're doing partnerships with the Louvre and the Hermitage and various other organizations. So the mission has remained the same. Really, it is to expose people to the arts. We have 50,000 people coming through the galleries here and the public programs here every year. Online, we're now approaching 100,000 views per year. And so that's very much in keeping with our mission, you know, is exposing people to the arts and all the art forms.
Okay. That rich history, could you explain some of the seminal moments in history that happened here? I mean, I believe there's one famous one, and given that we've just gone through a fairly tumultuous election, full of uncertainty, we won't get into. Maybe you could talk about, I believe his name was Tilden and Hayes?
Yes, so 1861, Samuel Tilden, governor of New York State, buys the house we're currently in, 15 Gramercy Park South. We're sitting in what was his bedroom, his first bedroom. 10 years later, he buys 14 Gramercy Park, which is next door. And he has Calvert Vaux, who's the co-architect of Central Park, bring the two buildings together as one. And he wanted to bring them together as one because he had a 40,000 book collection, which became one of the founding collections of the New York Public Library. Tilden was two-term governor, and if you were here, you would see that throughout the club there are 16 sets of double doors. Tilden, in his role as governor, broke up what was called the Boss Tweed. It was organized labor at the time. He broke up that Boss Tweed organization and as a result was terrified of being assassinated. If you remember, Lincoln was assassinated in the 1860s, and so he installed 16 sets of double doors, some right to our right here, or some in a pocket door right to our left here. And when he moved into a room, the doors would be closed behind him by his staff. And so this, Tilden ran for president. He was not a heavily political person by nature. He was called Whispering Samuel because he had a very soft voice. He was not really made for major public office, it would seem. He ran for president, and he actually won the popular vote, 1876. He wins the popular vote, and he goes to bed waving to the crowds here on Gramercy Park from the stoop. There was a stoop on 15 Gramercy Park at the time, waving to the thousands of people in front of him who all thought, like he did, like most of the newspapers in America, that he was the new president. It was not until many months later that Rutherford B. Hayes had more electoral votes and popular votes, and he was declared the president. Tilden then went away quietly to die. And so, yeah, it's a historic building, and lots happened here, and his family sold the building to the club in 1906.
Wow. And that's the start of the journey. Wow, yeah. It's amazing. Well, I wonder if you call him Dulcet Don. He doesn't really have a sort of soft voice. I don't think he'll go down the way of Tilden, that's for sure. Well, there's some other amazing things I discovered about the club. I didn't realise that amongst the many famous members, Mark Twain was a member, and that you also have something called the Medal of Honour that I believe, again, the list is extensive and impressive as to the type of people that you've awarded that Medal of Honour to. Perhaps you could just give a couple of examples.
Sure. So the Medal of Honour has a long history, and it basically our committees, two or three of them a year, come together and decide who they would like to recognize for their lifelong contribution to a particular art form. So it's W.H. Auden, Tennessee Williams, Norman Mailer, and Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Incredible.
You know, Saul Bellows, Allen Ginsberg, musicians. And so if you think through all of our committees, that means you've got artists from across the spectrum. We have a fashion committee. We just honored the fashion designer Anna Sui. Anna Sui was honored. You usually have someone comes who speaks on your behalf. Had Sophia Coppola came and spoke on her behalf, and the designer Mark Jacobs as well. And so these are usually black tie events held in our grand gallery for about 150 people. And really there, we give them the honoree gets a medal. They get their portrait done, which then goes into our portrait gallery downstairs. And the portraits for many, many years were done by a member and a longtime resident of our back building, Everett Raymond Kinsler. Ray has done 4 presidential portraits. He's done hundreds of others. He's got hundreds in the National Portrait Gallery. But as part of his gift to the club, every time we had a Medal of Honor here, he would do a portrait of the particular honoree.
And are these portraits on show all the time?
They are on show all the time down in our parlors.
Great, yeah.
Huge number of them, and Ray, you know, did these wonderful portraits of these people that have come through the club at some time. Ray lived in the back building for 70 years, and he just died a couple of years ago. So,
what a legacy. Amazing. You've talked about how things have changed and the upside of the pandemic for you in terms of the impact it's had on your growing digital program. New York's artistic soul, to a certain extent, has been squeezed out by just the recent years of gentrification. I mean, I've seen the city change just in the 10 years I've been here, and the prices rise and rental rises. Can you discuss your perspective on how art has changed in the city over, let's say, since you first came here in the 80s, when, you know, everyone's familiar with the fact that Soho was the artistic centre of the country? And maybe you'd also mention just the residences and the role they play for artists as well.
So I'm going to be contrarian on that whole argument about gentrification and the artists being pushed out. And if that were true, okay, so Soho was very, very popular in the 80s, and there were lots of artists living down there, 70s and 80s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and now it's all, you know, luxury boutiques and fancy lofts. If the theory was true, then artists would not exist now, right? Because Soho is closed, they've been pushed out, the art had been pushed. No, yeah, we've seen some of the greatest art of my lifetime happening in the last 10, 15 years. And so I don't buy into the gentrification is just, it's the migration of people through space, right? So, and if artists were only searching for free and open space, they'd be in South Dakota, you know, where the rent is cheap and there's lots of space. But they're not, they're in New York City. And so, are they in a different, are they in Soho? Are they in Chelsea? Before Soho, they were in the East Village. Now they're in the Lower East Side. Then there's Williamsburg. Then there's Greenpoint. It just changes, and that's okay. That's okay. I'm okay with change. I think we get concerned about gentrification, and it's a terrible thing, and populations being pushed out, which is a bad thing. But as far as artists are concerned, artists are going to create regardless of real estate. And so I think, you know, you look at what Dumbo in Brooklyn was. Dumbo 40 years ago, Two Trees Development, smart guy over there, decided he had a bunch of warehouse space on the Brooklyn waterfront that he was going to give to artists at a shopfront level, so there would be some street life there. The moment those artists, you know, the people started buying the condominiums and fancy apartments above, those artists were moved out, but that's okay. They were moved on somewhere else. That's the creative catalyst of artists, right? And I'm okay with that.
Okay, yeah. Certainly, there's plenty. I mean, if you just wander through Bushwick, there's a lot of art on show there. Last year, certainly during the lockdown and during the Black Lives Matter protests, we saw as a lot of the windows were covered and shuttered up with plyboards, we saw an explosion of art adorning these plyboards. Just extraordinary, particularly in Soho, where the artists had left.
Right.
But even just walking through there, I saw artists sort of on the street who are locals just painting and using that as an amazing canvas. You recently had an exhibition here of some of those artists' work that was, and I had the fortune to attend it. It was extraordinary. Could you maybe just give us a bit of insight into why you did that and the artists and the positive impact that's had?
Yeah, it was sort of richly ironic that artists came back to Soho, right? And they came back because the format of the buildings down there, they are old style, big windows, and they came back to paint on what were blank canvases, which is the plywood on the outside of all the luxury stores, over the old stores. And in talking to the artists, and there were numerous artists who did it, some individuals, some collectives, some people who met on the streets of Soho, the initial outpouring was a desire, we were all in lockdown, they couldn't work in their studios, a desire to go and create art. And it was, without casting a negative pole on it, it was largely about beautification. This is what some of the artists told me. As the Black Lives Matter protests and issues with race in America came to the fore in America over the summer, the messages on those plywood barricades and fronting of shops changed dramatically to reflect what was going on in America in this very, you know, pivotal moment in American history. And so the exhibition that we had, most exhibitions, usually in museums and cultural institutions, you're taking years to put exhibitions up. You know, you're like a movie studio. You're working on 20 exhibitions at a time. You're planning 5 years in advance. Maybe that means you've got 100 exhibitions in flow at any one time. And so the ability to pivot and quickly do an exhibition is a rare thing. Yet we had a cancellation in our schedule because we couldn't get one of the shows coming in from out of town. And we were presented with this opportunity that this group, this collective, who didn't know each other before, this Soho Renaissance Factory was the name of the collective. They came together and they created art and they found each other and they'd got a hotel down in Soho, had given them free space. And they were creating art, responding to
what
was going on.
That's incredible. I didn't realize that they were newly formed.
Yeah, completely newly formed. And it turns out there are other collectives. We're doing another exhibition in March with another one, Art to Heart. Unless you think that the art world lives in perfect peace and harmony with all these lovely themes, we actually wanted the two groups to work together. It turns out they couldn't work together. And so it was largely like West Side Story or something. So now we have two exhibitions. But the Soho Renaissance Factory is this wonderful collection of artists, most of them very young. Most of them had not shown in gallery spaces before, and they were talking about the change that needs to happen in our society and culturally diverse group. And it was an important exhibition. We felt it reflected. It's rare that you get to reflect what's happening now in the exhibition space. Usually you're reflecting what happened a decade ago, if not more. So this gave us some currency. It gave us something we felt was important. And what was an important part of the exhibition was adding photography from a photographer by the name of Graham McIndoe.
Shout out to Graham for recommending that we interview you.
Thank you, Graham.
That's why we're here.
Well, Graham is a terrific photographer, as you know. And he captured a lot of the Black Lives Matter protests that were happening across the city, as well as the desolation in the streets, as well as the boarded up stores. And so the combination of the plywood artworks, which are large scale artworks, with the photography added another element that really, I think, added to it and got a lot of attention for the club, got a lot of visitors. It was a special thing for us to be able to do. We have good relations with the artists still, so we hope to work with them again.
And we'll put those groups in the show notes, the Soho Renaissance Factory and the Art to Heart as well.
Yeah.
What are your hopes for art and artists in the city and the role art's going to play in helping the country heal? I mean, we're at a point where the polarisation that's been created a lot to do because of social media has created these divisions. And you, as you mentioned, you know, that movement, the beautification and the ply boards evolved into messaging, important messaging going around social, racial, even environmental justice that needs to happen. What sense do you have, or what hope do you have, that art can help us heal?
I don't necessarily see art's role to heal. I see art's role is to provoke, not in a negative way, but to provoke thought, to provoke change, to provoke questioning our norms. And that's, for me, all art doesn't have to do that, but artists working now who are working with what's going on in our world, responding to it, I think that's a fascinating conversation. These are creative people looking at the challenges of our society, and through their artwork, whether it be music, dance, theatre, or the visual arts, are offering sometimes some fascinating thoughts and processes and directions perhaps we should be looking at.
Do you think we're going to see a period of artistic expression that's going to be inspired or impacted by the recent events? I mean, I looked at last year when all this was happening. The UN put out a brief to creators to come up with ideas that would raise awareness around COVID. And I know that there was a lot of collectives around the world putting together really interesting work of different styles. And Shepherd Fairey, particularly his group, published a ton of really interesting, inspiring artwork. But, you know, the same way that, you know, the 60s had an impact on artists at that time, are you expecting to see a sort of a shift in the sort of art genres, or how art is created and how art is distributed?
I think the distribution is the opportunity for artists. The art world, the commercial art world, is a model that really hasn't changed over the years. You've got the gatekeepers being primarily the galleries, the auction houses being the validators as the collectors as well. It's a very hard world to break into, in the same way that while politically I don't embrace Donald Trump, I do find it fascinating the way he has utilized Twitter to bypass all the traditional media outlets of our country and our world. In the same way, artists have an opportunity to bypass the standard. I would hate to equate artists with Donald Trump, but there is an opportunity there to utilize some of these platforms that we have now to build an audience. I'm trying to now think of CJ Henry. CJ Henry is an Australian artist, and she has no gallery. Her works sell six figures, and she has built her success on social media and social media alone. And is she one of the world's great artists? I don't know. But you know what she's done is very interesting, and completely bypassing the traditional method. She doesn't want a gallery. She doesn't want a publicist. She's got a young woman who works with her, and she is that the model? I don't know. But that's, I think, an interesting model that we get offered through these opportunities with different social media platforms now.
And it's exciting.
Yeah,
you mentioned Donald Trump on Twitter. Now that he's not on it, my worry is that he's going to emerge on Clubhouse, the new platform that's going crazy at the moment.
I've got to say my blood pressure's gone down considerably now that he's not on Twitter, so that's great.
Yeah, we've got some respite for the moment. Yeah. Anyway, what's been your biggest challenge since taking over here? And what are your big focuses for the next few years here? I mean, obviously, you mentioned just that it's a very competitive landscape.
Yeah. Yeah, so this club has never had my position in its entire history. Executive director never existed. It's 71 employees here. Traditionally, it has been run, like many clubs in the city, with a general manager who's sort of your chief operating officer, but then a volunteer president. And that can lead you into bad places financially and from a governance standpoint. So I was brought in to try and rectify that. The challenge with change, it's like moving a large tanker, a large ship in the ocean. You've got to gradually, there are no radical turns here. It's a gradual turn to a big circle. And I'm trying to bring about, you know, we're a nonprofit organization. I'm trying to bring about a culture of philanthropy, supporting your nonprofit. Membership at anywhere, whether it be your gym or your club, is usually a transactional experience. I pay my money, I get a service delivered. It is not a philanthropic one. So changing that culture has been challenging and interesting. The way things are managed here, building committee, building consensus has been interesting. So there have been some challenges, but I've got to say it's been this wonderful opportunity to be part of. This is like if it was a heritage brand like Burberry. You've got an incredible history with a great, you know, product, in our case, the National Arts Club, and we have a chance to update it. We have a chance to make it relevant to the conversation around culture today, which is really what I saw as my goal. For many, many years, I worked in the arts and I ran media companies who covered the arts. No one would ever say, I'm going to an event, my friends or myself would go, I'm going to an event at the National Arts Club tonight, or a journalist would come back and say, hey, I covered something last night at the National Arts Club. It just wasn't important to the conversation of culture any longer. We don't have to be the producers of it, but I want to be part of the conversation. So a number of the changes that I brought about here that I thought was, in a country that has no minister of culture, there is a need for someone to bring people together. And I believe the National Arts Club can play some of that role. So I started bringing together cultural leaders, luncheons. So we have this great facility where you can have lunch, and usually our lunches are fairly slow anyway. So I started looking at small to mid-sized arts organizations in the tri-state area, New Jersey, Connecticut, New York, bringing them together because, you know, the dance world is always with the dance world, the theater world with theater and poetry and so forth, but they never commingle. And so I brought together every 2 months a different cohort of members, of executive directors of small to mid-sized arts organizations to sit down together. And at the start of the lunch, I'd get up and say, listen, they're going to be very short speeches, but here's the point of today. We all have in the arts a deficit of money. We don't have enough money. We don't have enough board members. We don't have physical space. We have many limitations, and yet there is always something we have in abundance. What I have in abundance at the National Arts Club is space. Physical space. What I can offer all of you at the table is an affiliate membership that allows them to use this space for their meetings, allows them to meet with funders, allows them to do board presentations here, allows them to utilize the space. And then I asked everyone at the table to stand up and tell the group what they could offer to their colleagues around the table. That abundance. What's that one issue you have, or that one asset you have in abundance that you can share? It turns out there are a lot of things that people can share. And for us, I was asked, well, what do you want out of this? I want a year from now, 2 years from now, someone to talk about a partnership that they've done that came because they met at that lunch. And that's what's happened. So, we have organizations in Staten Island meeting with organizations from the Bronx, people from Newark meeting with people from Connecticut. And that's a great model, I think, to bring people together who normally wouldn't meet, the serendipity that happens there. It turns out there are other communities that don't have that opportunity where the National Arts Club can play a role. A friend of mine's a cultural attaché with the Australian Consul General. She doesn't know the Swiss Consul General. She doesn't know the Dutch. So I started bringing together cultural attachés every 2 months. Now, if you're a European, the Europeans are very well organized. Of course, they get together every couple of months and know each other. But if you're from Taiwan, if you're from Brazil, you never get to meet any of these other people. So now we're bringing together every 2 months this cohort of cultural attachés, different each time, and then we'll bring them all together to share ideas.
That's really interesting, exciting, and just expansive in terms of the way you're thinking about your remit.
I think because, you know what, there are great producers. In the 122 years since we were founded, America has brought forth some great cultural institutions. We our role is to elevate those, promote those, to support those. We're not a producer necessarily of new operas, new poetry. We're a presenter. We're supporting those. And that's, I think, an important role of something like the National Arts Club.
It's interesting. I was going to ask you about how you're embracing diversity and inclusion, but what you just described for me is you are creating inclusion and diversity by hosting and creating spaces where people can come together from diverse backgrounds where they otherwise would never have met. You're creating an environment where I think I would expect serendipity will certainly flow and innovation will result.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, the challenge with a club or any membership club is there's always a gatekeeper. In our case, the gatekeeper is our members. To become a member of the National Arts Club, you have to be recommended by an existing member. That means they usually look like you, and you recommend people who are your friends. That's natural. But we live in a very polarized world, and so that means that you get a lot of people looking the same. And so to break that requires real work and a conscious effort, and that's what we're doing now. I mean, to belong to a club is a, for me, an interesting and a learning experience. I was learning for me. I sat in these parlors downstairs for a year before I really understood it. But we live in a city that is, there's no marketplace for gossip. We live in a city where we're mostly in small apartments. We live in a city where we're mostly anonymous. To come to a club like the National Arts Club or any social gathering place is to exchange gossip, mm-hmm. is to be recognized, is to be somewhere grand. In the case of this, you've got historic parlors. So it fills a real social and human need, and a human need that, by the way, post-pandemic, we're going to see more of.
Yeah.
You know, once we all have got our vaccine and we're walking down the street and we're thinking, God, it's great to be without a mask, we're going to realize, bloody hell, I was lonely. I really miss community. I want to be part of a community.
Yeah.
And that's where social clubs and other organizations, communities. I don't think it's an accident. You know, after everyone talks about the Spanish pandemic in 1918, the Roaring Twenties came right afterwards, right?
Yeah.
So that idea of re-engaging with people. I don't know if we'll quite have the Roaring Twenties here, but it gets lively, I can tell
yeah.
you.
Damn, bring it on. What role can brands play in your organization, given you are a 501c3, and maybe in terms of how sponsorship, and do you work with major brands?
So I had a long career of working with brands on both sides of the fence. So I worked at the Guggenheim, and my job was bringing in brands to engage in multi-million dollar, multi-year partnerships, Hugo Boss, Deutsche Bank, Delta, numerous others. And the enlightened sponsor can work with cultural institutions, get a lot out of it. So I'll give you an example. We initially worked with Deutsche Telekom. Deutsche Telekom, at the time, their primary experience, I'm sure they had many, many experiences, but one of the most visible to me as a bike rider, they sponsored the Tour de France, the great bike race. So their logo is on every square inch of the bike, of the bike rider, of the van, of the supporting material. They come to the Guggenheim Museum. They're about to go public, Deutsche Telekom, and they want to sponsor the Guggenheim, and they want to enter into a multi-year partnership. Their idea, their frame of reference was the Tour de France. And I said, you know what? If you want to deliver 100 million eyeballs, and you want your logo every 10 feet, this is not the right place for you. This is, you know, I'll be honest, I'd love your money. I'd love to have you as a partner, but you're not going to be happy. And what I would always sit down with partners, I'd say, a year from now, if we do a deal right now, a year from now, tell me the three things you want that are going to make you happy, because I want you to stay here. I want you to be happy. I want you to do more. And in that conversation, I quite often get a response from them that was unrealistic or was attainable or was not clear. And so that was the work. Defining success. And so in sponsorships, if you have a clear sense, a definition of success, I think that the arts can be a wonderful way to position a brand and work with sponsors, work as a sponsor. Having been on the other side of it, work with BMW, UBS, Deutsche Bank, most recently Pepsi, a well-informed sponsor can work with the arts and get a lot out of it. A poorly informed sponsor can do a great deal of damage and not do a particularly nuanced rollout. There were some elements of the campaign I worked on with Pepsi's brand Life Water. Life Water is a water brand, hydration yeah. brand, and they thought that early on that they should engage with artists to design their labels, which is great. Absolute Vodka had done that. in the 70s in New York, in America, many brands have done this, engage the arts to utilize as get artists. Chateau Lafite has done it. Various people have done it. The challenge with a brand like Life Water is it's a global brand. So you're rolling out a product in 100 countries and art is can be very specific. And so it became, ultimately, it was, I believe, not a great engagement with the arts. I loved the people at the company, incredibly well-meaning, incredibly smart, supported it well, but I don't believe they got a depth of engagement with the artists that really translated in a way that they saw fit. Even though it was, you know, I think it was $500 million in their first year they did it in Lifewater for their, just the US. I mean, it was a successful launch.
You've, along the way, you've obviously, you talked about the decisions you've taken and how you arrived to where you are, and you're in a position now where you have to evolve this organization, and we're in a clearly a time of significant change. What's your perspective on risk taking? And then you, I mean, you talked at the beginning about feeling being comfortable with discomfort. How do you embrace uncertainty and fear and confront the potential of failure? I know there's a lot in there, but
there
it's
is.
Just a
I mean, obviously the answer that I want to give is that you've got to embrace risk, you've got to embrace failure, you've got to embrace feeling uncomfortable. But no one wants any of those things. It's not like I say, bring it on, I love that. No, I hate that. I hate failing. I hate feeling uncomfortable. And yet, I know from experience, every time I've been in those situations where I've risked something, where I've taken a chance, great things have happened. And I think my younger self wouldn't have understood that emotionally. My older self does, that it's okay to feel uncomfortable. It's okay to feel out of your depth. It's okay to feel like you may fail. And with failure, being open to failure, but also being open to other ways of doing things, I think is incredibly important. We tend in life, one tends to get narrower in your beliefs because you start out very broad and you believe you know nothing, and so you'd like to refine it, and you get wiser and wiser and wiser. I was told recently, as I turned a certain age, I said, yeah, I'm getting wiser, but I was told by a friend, but yeah, but no one's listening. So, you know, I think you've got to invert the pyramid, right? So we've got to be more open as we get older, more open to other ideas, more open. And so quite often I'll have an idea of how I want to get somewhere. But instead of saying to people, listen, this is the goal, this is how we're doing it, this is how we're going to achieve it, I start with, this is the goal. How do you think we can achieve it? And, you know, maybe there are ideas that are going to be introduced that I never even considered. And being okay with that, because a lot of that is about ego, right? I think I've got, based on my years of experience, I have the answer. Now, I don't always have the answer. There are lots more people thinking smarter things than I every day, so let's be open to that. That's the key, I think.
Okay. Can we get to the quick fire questions?
Yes.
Yeah?
I can't remember them, but you can fire them.
What principles do you stand by?
Oh, I actually wrote those down somewhere because I thought, God, what do I stand for? I'm just in living it. Being uncomfortable, I said that. Risk-taking, embracing risk. Serendipity, that's a big one. Serendipity. Always be open to try and open your aperture in life, not close it. Be open to embracing new things, trying new things, taking a chance. Don't limit your risks, limit your chances. I think that is the singular thing. If I can pass on anything to my children, it is be open to chance, be open to serendipity.
That's nice. What hard choices have you made that might have been tough at the time but did turn out, and looking back, to be the right decision?
Coming to America, very tough. I left bucolic, warm, beachside Sydney to come to Trenton, New Jersey, which is an industrial wasteland in the middle of winter, not knowing a soul. That was hard. You know, I've been incredibly lucky in my career. I've worked really hard, but I've been lucky. I've been worked with some great people. I've had some wonderful experiences. So I would like to say there's something more influential, but that's
it.
That's the hardest thing.
I mean, aside from obviously the amazing galleries and walls and parlors here and the people that you meet, where do you go to discover new ideas?
I'm constantly reading, both print and online. I've taken during the pandemic, because we can't travel, to walking in this city, a city I've known for 30 years, a city I've lived in, Manhattan and Brooklyn. and my wife and occasionally our teenage son join us, and we set out for 10 to 15 mile walks through neighborhoods we've never been to before. Wow. Sometimes there's a restaurant that's doing outdoor dining involved along the way, but I've discovered neighborhoods I never knew existed. And just to be able to walk in this city and explore the Bronx, Queens, Far Brooklyn, all these neighborhoods as fast as Staten Island, all these things, it's been the greatest discovery of the city I know so well. Mm-hmm. And I think that is key, to be able to do something like that.
I'm envious. What I've been doing with my time. I've been getting on my bike and going the same direction up and down the Hudson.
That's what we do. In life, yeah. We probably repeat 90% of our pathways. I mean, we repeat everything time and time.
Note to self. Here, I didn't update. What's one problem we're solving?
Oh, I think I had an answer to that. Equality. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Equality. I've been the beneficiary of it, absolutely. But awareness of it and then acting to change it, I think that's a huge issue that we as humanity need to work towards solving.
Yeah, huge issue of our time. In this wonderful room, you could have a dinner party and invite four people from history to help you solve some of these big problems. Who would they be?
Ooh, I thought about that too. You know, I would love Barack Obama to be one. For a start, he's alive, so that'd be, you know, I've got a chance that at least he'd show up.
Past president, yeah.
Barack Obama.
He checks the box.
He just seems a smart guy. Do I agree with everything he's done? Absolutely not. But he seems like a guy who's really considered in his decision-making process and the way he brings in information. So Barack Obama. Nelson Mandela. I am inspired by his message. The life he led, I think, would be fascinating. I thought we'd need someone, if we were going to have a good dinner party, we'd need someone who isn't necessarily a brilliant person in history, but is a great conversationalist who knows a bit about everything. So Malcolm Gladwell. You know, Malcolm Gladwell is constantly thinking. He's a great synthesizer of other people's great thoughts and other people in history. And then I'd like a child. I'd like a child at the table. And I don't have any particular child in mind because those other three have great experience. I want someone who doesn't have experience at that table. I want a child who can eat with knives and forks, right? I don't want a five-year-old. I've dealt with that. But I want, you know, an articulate 14 or 15-year-old who can perhaps ask the questions that I'd be too scared to or wouldn't think of. And I think that would be an interesting dinner party.
Yeah, it would be a lively one. Okay.
I'm sure there are others, but that's the one that came to mind.
Good answer. Is there a question no one asks you that you wish they would?
Yeah. What do I cook? I'm a bloody good cook, and no one asks. I do an amazing tuna tartare that I cook on the barbecue. It's a one each piece. It's cooked beautifully on the outside with salt and pepper crusting, and then the inside is sushi quality raw. It is gorgeous, and I make it with a chimichurri sauce, which is sort of a mix of basil, cilantro, garlic, parsley, rice wine vinegar, and rock salt. You mix it all together. It's just perfect.
Well, I think
no one has asked me that question.
I think Barack and Malcolm Gladwell will definitely be lining up here for that dinner.
I didn't say I was going to cook for them.
Yeah. who's made you reevaluate yourself?
My children, absolutely. Before I had children, I've never spent a quarter of an hour walking one block of a city street. And the perspective that children give on life is very different. It's one we've left behind. And yeah, it was a radical transformation of who I thought I was and how I saw the world. When you see it through the world of your own children. Yeah.
All right. Impossible question. Any advice to someone that's graduating, entering studying, leaving studying, that's got a dream, big goal, big ambition, but has been told, forget it, that's impossible?
So the standard answer for that would be just keep pursuing your dreams. Go forth, young man, young woman. I would say, yeah, keep your dream, but perhaps you're not being creative in how you're reaching your dream. Maybe there are other ways. Maybe if you're dogmatically following the same path and people are telling you that path is not the one to go on, maybe there's another way to achieve that. And that's what you have to do in business and in life forever. You know, that's what I have to do in business. This is a goal I want to reach. I have a certain way I think I'm going to reach it, but maybe there are 10, 20 other ways to reach it. And I would say the same to anyone striking out in life. Yes, keep your goals, but think of creative, if you're hitting roadblocks, think of other ways to reach that. I think that I would, the other thing I would say about goals is don't talk to everyone about them, because the thing about achieving goals is it fulfills a human need to go to the end of the road, to reach the end of the journey. If you keep talking about the journey but don't go on the journey, then your need is fulfilled. So go and do it. Go and do it. Don't keep talking about it. Just go and do it.
Have you ever, I mean, it'd be interesting just to your perspective, have you ever been a goal setter?
Constantly. I can't stop myself. I set my goal. I write a list of what I need to achieve every night, what I need to do the next day, and then I redo that list, and it's constantly upgoing. It's an A-type personality. It's a game I try and I've played with friends, but I've also played with my kids. What do you do when there are no more goals? So I played this game. I remember walking down the street, and it was a $500 million lottery, and I saw a sign in my kids. I said, you know, what would you do with $500 million, that is? And I played this with my friends. When I first played it with one of my sons, he said he would buy a T-shirt and vegetables for the family. I realized he was too young to understand the concept of money, so I didn't play it with him for a couple of years. But I play it with friends, and I essentially ask, if you had $500 million right now or $1 billion, what would you do? And it turns out that people can usually buy a couple of houses. They can buy some art, maybe. They can buy a nice car or two. They have trouble spending more than 50, 100 million. So you still now got 900 million. What are you doing? What makes you get up in the morning, right? And so that's the essential question we're all asking ourselves. What makes me get up in the morning? Why do I do it? And so for me, that's all about list setting. You know? And so why do I get up is my list setting. But, you know, I think we have to find what is essential to keep us moving forward, to keep us happy, to keep us engaged. I mean, fulfillment in life is about human relationships, but also, you know, some of the wealthiest people in the world I know are miserable in life because they haven't got that human relationship or that other thing that keeps them going.
And driving purpose.
Yeah, the purpose.
All right, on the questions. Coming out of pandemic, mask off into a karaoke bar. What's that karaoke song?
Fly Me to the Moon, Frank Sinatra. I did a killer version of that in Seoul, Korea one time. I was fortunate. I was probably the only person who spoke English in the room. That was the thing that made my Frank version was great. Yeah, I'd have to say that. B, although you rarely see it on the karaoke playlist, is Timey Kangaroo Down Sport, only because I used to know the words to that. When I was
a classic Australian, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, well, we'll stick with the first one.
I think so.
Yeah. We've been obviously in lockdown and spent a lot of time in front of screens. Is there any seminal film, series, documentary you think people should watch that they might have missed?
I love The Lobster. Have you seen that movie?
No.
I can't even remember his name. The Lobster.
No, I heard of that one.
It's the same guy who did the period. Oh, you'll have to look it up. Anyway, it's great.
Lobster. Okay.
The Lobster.
We'll put that one
in. It's about how the premise being that you have to find a match in life. And if you don't find a match in life, you become an animal that you name. So they give you a certain amount of time. If you're not in a couple, if you're not coupled up, you've got to go to this special property somewhere out in the English countryside, and there's a chance you will hopefully couple up with someone there and have a happy life together. And if you don't, within a certain amount of time, you become the animal that you named. So in this, our hero's case, he named Lobster.
Wow. Okay.
It's brilliant. And other than that, you know, I have an ability to watch a fair amount of stuff and completely forget it.
I think it's a byproduct of lockdown.
I've started about 13 different series, and I look back through Netflix and the other platforms, and I realize I never got through half of them. I've been reading some good books, but you know.
Well, that's the next question. We want to offer listeners that come up with the best comments in Instagram or the comment section on the site, book of what would you recommend that we give them?
Best book to read in these days is José Saramago's Blindness. Nobel Prize winner, gripping tale of blindness afflicting a town, except our patient zero's wife. The people who are afflicted with blindness are put into a compound. the military give them food every day, and then one day the food doesn't come, and the people who are blind inside the compound realize that everyone outside the compound is now blind, and blindness afflicts the whole country. It's a gripping tale, beautifully told. Jose wow. Samaramago, Nobel Prize winner, dead, unfortunately. I would recommend that. If not that, you're going to go with a classic like, you know, Gladwell's Tipping Point or something like that.
No, we'll stick with blindness. Okay. Yeah. Final question. Who should we interview next?
You know, you'd mentioned Community, I think, when you and I met before.
Yeah.
And so, and you'd said, you know, what's the name of the Community app that you and I discussed?
Next Door.
Mm. And so that for that very reason, I think you've got to go and talk to my friend Mariam Benakaram, who's the chief marketing officer at Next Door. Mariam, wonderful, smart person. She and I were interns together at Brooklyn Academy of Music in 1989. She took the smart option and went and did an MBA. And then, but she is an Iranian-American, brilliant, kind, and generous. And during lockdown came up, co-founded an organization called NYC Next, which is about bringing life and artists and restaurants and life back to the city of New York. She's who you've got to talk to, Mariam Benakaram.
We'll take you up on that. And we usually wait till the episode's live and then use that as an intro for you to make the intro and the email.
Okay.
So a couple of weeks' time. That'll be good. So just wrap up and thank you very much for your time, your generosity, and welcome us to this incredible, inspiring space. And acknowledge you just for your spirit of adventure. It's inspiring. And we had a guest recently who, his name's Gillian Burke, is a broadcaster in the UK, a really lovely woman and smart and environmentalist. And she used this word, liminal, felt that she was in this liminal space in her life, of always in transition. And it feels, and when you were talking, it just brought that back to me, the sense of liminality that you seem to embrace, to always be in this this process of sort of change and transition and improvement. And a fact that you acknowledge yourself to have the courage to admit that you are comfortable with discomfort and embracing discomfort, I think, is another inspiring quality that people should strive to embrace, because I think we could all be better humans if we do that. And finally, just acknowledge you and thank you for your imagination to create this space of networking, connectivity between other artists, leads to a better city and hopefully a better nation. So thank you very much.
Thank you. A pleasure.
Cool. Thanks. Okay, that's all for this week, folks. If you're enjoying the show, please subscribe, rate, recommend, or review, depending on where you listen. And if you have someone you'd like us to interview, just DM us on Instagram at The Impossible Network or email us at info@theimpossiblenetwork.com. And please give our other podcast, The Raw Hospitality Show, a listen. They are both Fabrica Collective Productions. See you next time.